Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Now, we've been bombarded by statistics over the last year and a half. 7 day rolling averages, R numbers, excess death. They've been trotted out and still are being trotted out every night on TV. And we try to make some sense of those numbers, but sometimes it's quite tricky. Let's put it that way. Let's talk about a book which attempts to do that job for us rather well. It's called COVID by Numbers, and one of its authors, Professor David Spiegelhalter, joins us now. Morning, David. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yes, I mean, I think that's probably not understating it somewhat to say that the numbers that have been thrown at the public in the last couple of years are somewhat perplexing.
Well, it's extraordinary. I'm a statistician. You know, I love numbers. Yeah. But frankly, even I've seen enough of them over the last 18 months or so. Honestly, I mean, we're just bombarded with a pandemic of data. And and because, you know, it's my bread and butter, it's what I do. And I've, you know, from being a, you know, a real backroom nerd, suddenly you get asked by the media to go on and explain stuff and expected to know everything. And it's been very exciting. And so my colleague Anthony Masters and I decided we'd try to distill all the kind of things we've had to talk about down into a reasonably short book.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it was a challenge. And I guess the first and most obvious question is that when you are compiling stats, then where do you go to for the data from which to compile those stats? And how do you know that data is trustworthy?
Well, I suppose that's what the book is about, because as statisticians, we're the ones actually who are most sceptical about the numbers. You know, you sort of think that social media say, oh, you can't believe any of these stats. Well, we say you've got to be really careful with all these stats. And we use all the sources that are available, the national data, the public health agencies, the national death registrations. And we're very open, as they are, in fact, if you read more carefully, to say you've got to take a lot of these numbers with a pinch of salt. You know, we don't know how many people have had the virus. We don't know how many people have been ill. We don't know how many people have died because of it. It's even difficult to define what that actually means. Different countries use very different definitions for COVID deaths. They count things in different ways. Got to be really careful making comparisons and so on. But at the same time, you know, these numbers, we have to have some idea of what's going on. So they are vital. So I guess our lesson is, yeah, we've got to look at these things, but you know, be a little bit cautious about them.
Very interesting that you list it like that, saying that, you know, how much we don't know. What do we know then? Let's see if that's an easier one. What can we say for absolute certainty are facts? What did you kind of come across that you could say irrefutably, these are facts which you can't disprove?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, this is a virus. It's very nasty. It's far worse than if you're unvaccinated. It's far worse than flu. If you're vaccinated, it's probably about as bad as having flu, because you do get it even if you're vaccinated. So it's a nasty thing, and it's caused a lot of harm to people.
Yeah.
You know, we know that far more, whether they're COVID or whatever you call them, whether have they been labelled, there have been far more deaths over these periods than we would have expected. And countries like the UK have done very badly indeed. There were these big spikes, followed by quite big dips, of course, when fewer people have died than you'd have expected. So, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but the one thing we can do, and I'm pleased forgiving for this language, but I am a statistician, is count the bodies.
Yeah.
Because that is a fact. And when more people are dying than you'd expect, far more, something is going on. So there are some definite facts there. Now, trying to tease those out to what they actually mean is quite tricky. But we do know, for example, that vaccines work. We know that they have a big effect. And we know that not just by looking at what happens now, but because of these big randomized trials that have been done and so on. So there are some things, and we try to focus on what we do actually know and then admit, well, there's a hell of a lot we don't know. In particular, of course, we don't know what's going to happen. Well, yeah. You know, the uncertainty about the future is very large indeed.
The problem with a lot of this, I guess, for the general public, myself included, to get their head round, is that even somebody like you who knows what they're talking about is saying to us here, well, we don't know everything about this, and we can only kind of hazard guesses at some of it. It depends on how you count it, all the rest of it. But based on those counts, people's lives have been irrevocably altered. You know, jobs have been lost. People have been locked in their homes, you know, for a considerable period of time, particularly us here in Spain, actually. We suffered a very bad lockdown. And those were based on exactly the kind of numbers you say that they weren't sure about.
Well, but the point is they're not often not based, they know something's happening, and we know that something had to be done. You know, basically, if you just let it rip before the vaccination, we knew that we absolutely were sure, even though, you know, we never actually saw it, that this would have a really terrible consequence. So something has to be done. But as we emphasize in the book, the exact impact of all these different things that people do, you know, how much does working from home, face masks, not going into the shops, you know, it's closing schools, how much does each of those individual things contribute to slowing the spread of the virus? We still don't quite know what, you know, these out of this whole package of stuff that we've had to do, what actually works the most is still up for some dispute. But there's no dispute that in the end, changing behavior does prevent the shift in the virus. Mm. What's interesting in the UK is that, you know, back in July, we essentially abandoned pretty well all the rules, but behavior didn't change that much. And so we didn't have any spike after the rules went and there was no spike. So what that shows in the end, that it's not the rules that actually make all the difference. It's how people act and what people do that makes the difference. And that, of course, is the least predictable thing, is how people will respond.
Yes, and I guess a lot of that response, we've talked about this on the show before, and it's no secret that the government had had their own department making sure that people were scared enough into doing things that they wanted them to do. That's not a secret. You know, they've openly admitted that was the case. They had a program in order to do that. And if I notice a lot of your figures, you quote Imperial College, which, you know, before this, probably most people had never heard of, and most people had never heard of, for example, the epidemiologist Professor Neil Ferguson. And this was a man who, frankly, how he's not been sacked is beyond me, because if I got that many predictions wrong over a period of time, I would expect to be sacked. And Ferguson made some quite outrageous predictions from 2002 onwards, to which the government reacted and then carried on doing it into the COVID crisis, and then ends up admitting that he was using a 13-year-old computer code that wasn't intended to be used for COVID at all. When you look at those kind of things that come out, you think, well, hang on a minute, then how can we believe any of this nonsense?
No, I'm not getting into all of that. There's loads of stuff that's been thrown around that frankly isn't the case, and I'm not going to get into a detailed character assassination on one person.
That wasn't my question at all. My question was, if we are taking our numbers from someone who is advising the government, who has been proven to in the past have got those numbers wrong.
Come on. There's in Britain, there's at least four teams doing all this stuff. You know, the Imperial Group, has been picked on and been criticised. They're just one group of people. Neil Ferguson got a certain priority. You know, he gets a lot of coverage. But actually, no, there's four different teams all producing these things, all producing projections, some of which have been better than others, because they're based on a range of different assumptions. So, you know, and what went on in 2002, I don't think is of any interest at the moment.
Okay, we'll move on. Let's talk about the actual numbers that you talk about then in the book, and some of the facts, which are quite striking. At one point, you say that we might say that getting COVID-19 is like packing a year's worth of risk into a week or two. So what does that mean? How did you arrive at that?
Yeah, that's a story. I developed that idea about even one, you know, 18, right back at the beginning in March 2020. It looked like before vaccination that if you got the virus, it was high risk, but the risk depended enormously on your age, in the sense that essentially how your back normal risk of dying, older people are at far higher risk than dying than kids are. And similarly for COVID, it matches almost exactly your usual risk it just accelerates, it just multiplies it up hugely. And so the usual risk you've got of dying each year, which varies according to how your vulnerabilities, your age, and so on, it packs that much risk into while getting infected, essentially a week or two. Because it doesn't substitute for it. It means it doubles up the risk you've normally got if you get the virus. So I don't know if it really, I thought it was quite a good idea, but I think people have misunderstood it. So maybe it wasn't great communication. But for me, it tried to illustrate the fact that a 90-year-old has got 10,000 times the risk of a 10-year-old, which is, you know, it's very difficult to get your head around the fact that age, COVID hates old people. I mean, it really persecutes age. And, yep. You know, no matter how old you are, every year you get older, your risk of dying if you get COVID goes up by about 6 to 7%. So, you know, it penalizes age all the way through. That's another great, really unknown thing. Why does it do that so much? Why does it pick on older people so much? Unlike normal seasonal flu, which doesn't have such a strong pattern at all.
This is the interesting one, isn't it? It's picking out from that data what the cause of death was listed as. And this has been a contentious one, and I know you'll know that, you know, yourself. When we see the numbers trotted out on the national TV, on the BBC every night, saying, you know, people who died with a positive COVID test, within 28 days of receiving a positive COVID test, and then we get the naysayers on that who say, well, hang on a minute, if they got run over by a bus, they still go down as a COVID positive.
It's absolutely true. And at one point, they didn't even have that 28 days in there, which really was...
No, they didn't.
You could never recover from COVID. But they corrected that. And actually, those 28, there aren't that many people run over by buses in the month after being COVID.
No.
So, fortunately. So, actually, those figures, which are just the daily figures, they're not the reliable figures at all. You know, but they do happen to match reasonably well. You know, when we look at the data a few weeks later of the people who actually died with COVID on their death certificate, they follow that trend, not exactly, but reasonably well. So they do give an appropriate impression of what's going on. But they're not the gold standard figures at all. And the crucial thing also is that these are people on the death certificate measures people dying with COVID. And many people have said, oh, well, they just got COVID and then they die of something else. So that's 90% of people who have it on their death certificate died with COVID as the underlying cause. But also 90% of people who die with COVID have got something else. So very few people who die of COVID are perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's because COVID's just takes, as I said before, it takes any vulnerability, any weakness you've got, and magnifies it and accelerates it and exaggerates it. It's a really nasty thing. So naturally, it picks on people who have already got some vulnerability.
There was a very interesting study done at Hopkins University in America by Genevieve Briand, who's is working there, and she looked at the COVID deaths in America. She got her figures from the CDC, and she was talking about it related to other causes of death. And this, of course, is another kind of biggie, which no doubt you'll have seen in your data of the other top three, effectively heart disease, respiratory diseases, influenza, pneumonia. And she was saying that every year in the US, when they observe the seasonal ups and downs, there's an increase of deaths due to all causes. That's the kind of thing which happens every year. But she noticed that when COVID struck, there was a significant decrease in death due to those other causes. So she prophesizes on that maybe then they were classifying the COVID deaths completely wrongly.
No, there's a few things. First of all, there's COVID, because of all the protection we've been taking, there's been no flu. So we've saved, you know, possibly 10, 20,000 lives over the last winter in the UK from all the lockdown measures. Now, what's going to happen this winter when we might be hit doubly hard is another matter with flu. But we've, in a sense, this lockdown has had a huge benefit in terms of it's also reduced road accidents. But I'm not going to say it's a great thing,
we should
be doing. But it has had these sort of positive collateral effects. In terms of other causes, yes. I mean, people who have died with COVID on their death certificate, many of them would have died anyway, of other things. And also people whose deaths are brought forward. And that's why actually it is good to look at, you know, as you mentioned right at the beginning, excess deaths, to, you know, what people have on their death certificate. It can tell you something, but, you know, that can vary depending on the practices in each country. In the end, it's good to look at just how many people are dying, regardless of the cause. And then it doesn't, as I said, count the bodies, which is, yep, that sounds really, yep, heartless, but, yep, actually is the accurate thing you can do. And then you see these spikes, which are essentially unprecedented since 1918. And so then you do get a feeling that whatever people are doing, whatever people are, how they're labeling these things, something really big has been going on.
Mm. Do you look in the book at other countries, David, and how they have crunched these numbers? Are the UK crunching them in a different manner to other countries?
Every country does different things. And that's why, again, when you come to comparing countries, it's best just to look at the excess deaths, just how many deaths have been recorded. Even that, of course, doesn't work if the country hasn't got a very good death registration system. You know, India, they don't even know how many people have died of anything. And so I think when you do that, by the end of the first wave, the UK was top of this ghastly league table in Europe pretty well. It was doing worst of all. And now it's, you know, not doing quite so badly because other countries, especially in Eastern Europe, have had a very bad time. You know, we were very fast with our vaccines. It saved a lot of lives. And so, I wrote an article in May 2020 saying it's too soon to start making international comparisons. Right. We've got to wait.
Yep.
I didn't realize we'd have to wait so long, because I still would say it's still too soon to make international comparisons, because this isn't over yet. And so, you know, I don't like this whole league table business, but of course it is valuable to see what other countries do. We should be looking at other practices to work out, you know what might work, might not work. I mean, Sweden's an interesting example, which had very limited rules, but actually people's behavior was really quite stringent in terms of keeping distance and things like that, which again shows, as I was mentioning about the UK, in the end, it's not the rules that count, it's what people do. That's what has the effect. Rules themselves don't have an effect. It's people's behavior that has an effect. And people, as UK is showing at the moment, can behave in a really quite a disciplined way without any rules.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you think you'll be writing another one of these books in a couple of years' time, or do you hope we're over the worst of it now and we're on the downhill slope?
Yeah, I hope not. I hope I don't want to ever talk or think about this stuff again. But it is interesting trying to distill. I mean, you know, doing journalism is tricky. You know, you've got to try to boil down a complex topic into a very short speech. And for me, it's been a real lesson. And with my colleague Anthony Masters, you know, the reason we wrote this book is that we got a column in The Observer, the, you know, national newspaper, on Sunday every week. But we're only allowed, and we've done it since January, we've done 36 of these columns, but we're only allowed 350 words. Now, have you ever tried to I'm sure you must talk a lot more than 350 words, and at a time. So it is really difficult to boil down a complex argument into 350 words, and so that's what has been for me a real lesson in trying to get these ideas over in a concise way.
Brilliant. Well, for those of us who are not just like me, who love maths and statistics, the book is way broader than that and can be enjoyed by everybody. And you'll learn something by reading it. COVID by Numbers. It's called. David Spiegelhalter. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. You take care of yourself.
Yeah. Great pleasure. Thank you.
All the
best.
Cheers.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So that means a half day. Yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds low after 35 gigabytes of network busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.